Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac DeVere.
The joy that I feel in being in a room in Huntsville, Texas, with 400 people that I've never met before who are so excited about the future of this state and so eager to share with me what's on their mind. I love that. And I've never experienced campaigning like that before. There's some real joy, not just for me or from me, but from people who are coming to this.
Joyful was a word that Hillary Clinton would sometimes use to describe her campaign. And
so scratch what I just, said. Delete.
Today's guest, Beto O'Rourke, the Texas congressman and Democratic nominee against Ted Cruz in Texas for the Senate seat Cruz has held since 2013. We're going to be doing a lot of candidate conversations this year, but there's a reason I want to start with O'Rourke. He's running a race that most people expect him to lose, and he's going for it anyway. And he's doing it as a Democrat counting on changing political prospects in the state that's generally seen as the heart of the Republican Party's political prospects. Democrats have been talking for years about turning Texas blue, and it never happens. The other thing that struck me about O'Rourke, and this is what I covered in the article up on the Politico website about this interview, is that he has not become the kind of national Democratic cause that others have. He's no John Ossoff, for example. He's also not Wendy Davis, who I talked to for the article. She was the 2014 candidate for governor who told me that if O'Rourke is going to win, he's going to need to raise the money to stay competitive, and that means getting a little more attention. Then again, she lost by 21 points. O'Rourke has a whole anti-establishment routine, but he loves doing interviews. So I started this one off talking to him about the two things I see come up most, that he was in a punk band in college and that he looks like a Kennedy. Both those things are true. So I think this becomes the first off message that includes a candidate quoting his own punk lyrics, which I guess we can stack up next to that Carole King tribute song Jay Inslee told me a few weeks ago that he wrote. Ted Cruz's spokesperson didn't respond to me about getting his views into the story that's up on the site, but I'm hoping he'll be here for a podcast soon. I've asked. In the meantime, we have an awesome lineup coming up. Pete Buttigieg on what he's up to politically and whether he's running for president. Congressman Matt Gaetz on Russia conspiracy theories that he thinks might be true. Michael Tubbs on being the 27-year-old mayor of Stockton, California, and Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rossello on the rebuilding that's happening there and the rebuilding that isn't happening there after the hurricane. So make sure you subscribe and spread the word and get a family member or friend or coworker signed up too. Rate us, leave a comment on Apple Podcasts or whatever you're listening to this podcast on, and email me at isaac@politico.com with your thoughts on this or any of the other interviews or who else you'd like to hear from. There were some people out there who wrote to me to say they wanted to hear from O'Rourke, and now check it out. Here we are. And remember, of course, to follow me on Twitter at Isaac DeVere and like me on Facebook. And now my conversation with Beto O'Rourke.
I feel like the obligatory thing to talk about with you is your punk rock past. So let's start with that. You were in a band called Foss. Where does the name Foss come from?
I was told that it is the Icelandic for waterfall.
So it wasn't your idea?
No. Mike was reading, I believe, a National Geographic, came across the word, liked it, and that became the name of the band.
Describe the sound that we're talking about here. This is mid-90s punk
rock.
This
is early 90s, simple three, maybe four chord punk rock, messy, loud, very heartfelt. Mm-hmm. Arlo Klar, who was our singer and principal songwriter, just incredibly emotive and emotional and just powerful and beautiful in terms of connecting with the feelings behind the song. And I think that was very characteristic of the band. And just four really good friends who felt comfortable, like, you know, if Arlo wanted to play guitar on something, maybe I'd play bass.
But you were on guitar normally.
We all preferred to be on guitar, and each of us would take a hit and get on bass if we had to. And of course, Cedric consistently on drums. And just,
You never picked up the drums.
I did, but not in Foss. And just Cedric, just a power behind the kit and so creative. I didn't realize how creative drumming could be until I had a chance to play with Cedric. And, you know, even then, you know, many years ago, more than 25 years, I guess now, you could just tell how talented Cedric was and what an excellent performer, even behind the drums he was then. And certainly we see that today in Mars Volta and At the Drive-In and Antimask and other bands that he's been in. So
does it make you feel jealous that someone actually went, made some money, made a living?
Yeah, it makes me so proud of him and just really proud as an El Pasoan. No, we're this town growing up there. We all went to El Paso High, except Mike went to Coronado. But, you know, just that this kid from El Paso High, along with Jim Ward, who was also in At the Drive-In, that they made it big. And
that was the dream for you too. And you, I mean, yeah. You're doing okay. You're in Congress, yeah. Right?
No, absolutely. That when I was 19, 20 years old, that was absolutely the dream. Starting our own label, Western Breed Records, putting out our own records, writing our own songs, booking our own tours, driving ourselves in a station wagon across the country in Canada to play shows wherever we could. It could be a basement or a church hall or a bar or a nightclub. You know, wherever they would have us, we'd play. And it was just one of the most amazing experiences of my life. So even though it took place so long ago, it in so many ways informed how I approached things that came afterwards, including politics. You know, is there a way to do this in a non-corporate way and to do it as honestly as you can and connect with people in as direct a fashion as possible?
Give me a sample of one of your songs, one of the ones that you wrote.
I don't know that I can. You mean like a cappella sing a punk rock song from 25 years ago? No.
What are the just a sense of the lyrics that you were putting together?
That's a great question. You know, I had a song called The Floor, just about, you know, you're 19 years old and you're full of angst and depression and energy. And just being so depressed that you're on the level with the floor. I think the floor comes up to meet me. Is the opening line of the song. You would never see me, or you don't believe me, something like that. I think that's the rhyme.
That sounds the very opening like couplet. 19-year-old boy writing punk songs.
But what was so cool about it was you could just pick up a guitar, no matter how bad a poet or no matter how bad a musician, you could get up on stage and share your story, and it blew through the secret handshakes and the corporate control and the radio delivering you your music. And it was just, you go make your own songs if they're not talking about your life or what you're excited about. And so that was absolutely thrilling and just very cool to be a part of.
The other thing that everybody seems to write about you in any piece is that you look like a Kennedy, right? You've got the teeth of a Kennedy. Yeah. Have you ever used that to your advantage? You ever like slip in?
No, I'll tell you a time where maybe I could have. We were Republicans and Democrats who'd been elected in 2012 to the House. We're going to a Harvard-hosted orientation in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Well, there's a place to pull the Kennedy card, right?
And I'm in a bar after the first day of orientation, and I'm with my fellow classmates, Eric Swalwell and Tulsi Gabbard and Joe Kennedy. And this woman comes up to me, and she's like, "Are you who I think you are?" And I thought, I just won this seat in Texas and she knows about me and this is cool. I'm big time. And I say, "Well, yeah, I think I am." And she's like, "You got to come over to my table. All my friends want to meet you. This is crazy." And so I go over and we're taking pictures. And then it dawns on me that she thinks I'm Joe Kennedy or a Kennedy.
You don't have
somebody.
His red hair.
I don't have his red hair, but I can tell from the, you know, picking it up that it's not Beto O'Rourke that they're interested
so
in.
So how do you break that news to them?
Well, it was just in the middle of like the third or fourth picture. I said, "Oh, hold on a second. Wait, it's not me you're looking for. It's that guy." And I went over and I got Joe Kennedy. And it turns
he
out
he complied.
Actually, what's that? Yeah, he complied and the greatest guy in the world. And it turns out the irony was we were also with Eric Swalwell. And they were his constituents. They had come from California. They were doing something in Boston or at Cambridge. And so not only did they not recognize him, they certainly didn't recognize me. They were there for Kennedy. So that's been the only kind of brush with Kennedy fame that I can remember.
Although he says, right, that's his line, that you're the best looking Kennedy on Capitol Hill.
Well,
right?
Yeah, he's being funny and generous.
There are a lot of politicians who are shaped by their fathers in ways of them being absent. Your dad was really very much part of your political upbringing before you even knew that you wanted to be anywhere near politics. He was like the local big shot, it seems like.
Yeah, he was an absolutely powerful force in my life, as maybe every dad is to every one of his children. And certainly in my formative years as a 8-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old being around politics with a successful politician. He was a county commissioner and then a county judge at a time that Texas was still a Democratic state. Mm-hmm. And so
living in El Paso.
Living in El Paso. And so, you know, when Governor Mark White is going to come to town, he's coming to the O'Rourke House and he's going to talk to my dad. When Jesse Jackson is coming through.
Your dad was the chair of his campaign,
He was the co-chair for Texas for the Jesse Jackson campaign. When Walter Mondale is going to come
to town. Even when Texas was more Democratic, to be the co-chair of Jesse Jackson's campaign in Texas seems like far out there.
And it's connected to another impression of that time, which is that this was really fun. And they're having a great time. And there's energy in the Jesse Jackson campaign. He's bringing,
is the 88 campaign?
I believe so, if I can remember correctly. But he's bringing people into this that haven't been a part of this before. And people are excited in a way that they never have been before. And there was just there was a joy in what they were doing. It wasn't the carping, grinding, small, petty, weak stuff that so many people, not just myself, so many people associate with politics today. There was just genuine joy. And it may have something to do with being a Democrat in El Paso and at a time where to be a Democrat in Texas was something different than it is today.
You do the punk rock thing. You explored a bunch of other career stuff in New York. Gave up on New York. Never a good idea to give up on New York, but I guess it brought you back to Texas.
Right.
And then you slowly work your way into politics. It seems like he had planted seeds in you that you didn't even realize were there. What does he say to you as that is happening? Does he say, like, I knew this was always going to happen?
You know, it's interesting. He died well before I ever ran for office or considered running for office. He died in 2001. I first ran for city council seat in 2005. But
it was coming, though, right?
Here's the thing. When I moved back to El Paso in 98.
You were getting involved, I guess.
I was getting involved. And I'd actually had kind of a split with my dad. I mean, not, again, perhaps too different than what any young man and his father go through. Just can't see eye to eye, can't quite connect. Wasn't into the punk rock. Why are you getting an English degree? You're taking loans. We're taking loans. You know, do something productive with your life.
Yeah. Look what I'm doing. It's not productive.
Yeah. See? He was afraid of this very outcome. But I moved back and I did two things with some really good friends and with my dad. We started an online newspaper because we thought El Paso was the coolest, most amazing city on the planet. And in all of El Paso, to include Ciudad Juarez. And no one was writing these stories. And so we were writing those stories. And that was really exciting. It was also, at least in El Paso, the advent of online journalism. This is 1998, going into 1999. And then really to supplement that pursuit, we started an online website development, application development, software marketing company that was relatively successful. And he really helped guide me through that, took a $20,000 loan to make it possible. And again, once again, there was joy in it. Like, look at all the amazing stuff that's going on in El Paso. Let's write about this and explore it and
discuss
it.
But that's you getting involved in, again, not politics and running for office, but
civic life.
Right. So he must have felt like you finally came home, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And we connected beyond the business and the newspaper and the enterprise. Just, you know, as father, son, now both as adults going on backpack trips together, meeting at the Cincinnati bar for a drink after work, you know, having the conversations that you couldn't have when you were a kid with your dad. So, no, I'm super grateful for those years.
And then it was basically a freak accident that he died in, right?
It was. Yeah. He, you know, this guy who had been a cyclist all his adult life had cycled the Rockies from El Paso to Canada. Had cycled across the United States a couple of times, had cycled the Alps, is cycling, you know, not more than a 15-minute drive from where he lived. And early morning sun's coming up, driver doesn't see him in the glare and kills him.
When you run, is he in your head then? It seems like that any parent dying would be a seminal moment, but it did come at that moment where you're making this slow progression transition into getting involved.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it, I don't know how to explain. I don't know if the right way to describe it is it makes things more real. It certainly made me realize that this person who had such a dominating presence in my life and had just recently been such a source of help and inspiration and confidence as we were starting this enterprise that we didn't know what the hell we were doing. So to lose him, I thought, you know, now this is squarely on me to do these things and to fully grow up and grow into what I'm supposed to do in life. But to your question, yeah, I mean, he's still with me. I mean, he's part of my consciousness.
What do you think he'd make of this Senate run?
Oh, I think he'd love it. And it gets back to something that he had that I wish I had more of, which is just the absolute joy in life and living and finding that in people, in whatever he was doing, and not doing something if it wasn't bringing him joy. So I think he'd just be like, you know, holy shit, I can't believe you're doing this. You're now the Democratic nominee for the state of Texas, and you guys are running this 254 county grassroots no PAC campaign. What are you thinking? This is awesome. So I think he'd have.
Would it be what are you thinking, or this is awesome?
Which would be both of those things? Because you know what we're trying to do is certainly win this race. It's important. We have to win, but we're also trying to do it in the right way. And it doesn't mean in the righteous way. It doesn't mean in like, you know, the most ethical way, although we certainly want to run a very ethical campaign. It means doing this in the way that it's supposed to be done. And not to overuse this word again, but the joy that I feel in being in a room in Huntsville, Texas, with 400 people that I've never met before who are so excited about the future of this state and so eager to share with me what's on their mind. I love that. And I've never experienced campaigning like that before in anything that I've done or anything that I've been a part of with other campaigns. And sure. So there's some real joy, not just for me or from me, but from people who are coming to this. And very often from the other side, you hear about anger and rage, and I don't see it. And I certainly don't feel it. And I think there's something very special in that.
Joyful was a word that Hillary Clinton would sometimes use to describe her campaign. And most people
scratch what I just, said, delete.
She would say joyful. You were saying joy, but it was not for people who covered that campaign and not only her campaign operation, but the campaign events.
Right.
The most joyful
right.
thing.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about long before anybody knew that she had a problem.
Right.
So it's a different kind of thing that you're going for.
Yeah.
What is it? I was talking to a Democratic operative, pays a lot of attention to Senate races earlier, and I said, I'm talking about you, and I said, what do you make of this? And person said to me, look, you know, when he said he was going to run for Senate a year ago, everybody said, sure, okay, whatever. I didn't really pay attention to it.
Right.
You're running in Texas. It's a tough thing to do. That's part of it. Part of it is that you are relatively unknown in the state, or were, and you've not been in Congress that long. What is the moment that tips it over for you that says, like, I've got to actually run for Senate and do this crazy thing?
It goes back to November of 16 and watching the returns with my wife, Amy. And it just...
At home?
At home. We have this.
I was at the Clinton party that night, probably a different scene.
Yeah, and we'd had this low key watch party, if you even want to call it that, with folks that we work with and people on the campaign, and just, I mean, low key, like low energy, like we know what's going to happen. And after about an hour, we said, "Hey, everyone, thanks for coming over. Amy and I are going to put the kids to bed, and we'll see you later." And as the returns continued to come in, and it really hit us what was happening in the country, and the rhetoric and the direction that this could possibly take us in: walls, Muslim bans, press, you know, as the enemy of the people. Again, this smallness, this paranoia, this hatred, this vilification of Mexico and Mexicans and our community where we live, which I'm so proud of, you know, the largest binational community.
You think the president's paranoid?
Yeah. And trying to be paranoid on behalf of America about, you got to be scared of these Mexicans who are coming to rape you and kill you. You got to be scared of these Muslims who just want to blow themselves up in your community. So we got to ban them all from coming in here. It just was not us. Not us, the O'Rourke's. It just wasn't us as a country. This isn't America. And it was really my wife who hates politics, like hates politics. And I'm the
only... Does she know what you do for a living?
Well, she didn't when we started dating. I'm the only Democrat in all of Congress, in the House or the Senate, who subscribes to term limits. I've introduced term limit legislation. I have term limited myself in the House and will in the Senate if elected.
And how many in the Senate, if you win?
Two.
12 years and out.
Yeah. And a lot of that is because I think that the institution needs it, and it would add some urgency and make sure that that place reflects more of America. But it also has a lot to do with Amy. She's like, there's no way you're going to go up there and spend your life up there. I'm not doing that with you, and you're not going to be one of those people. So,
but she's ready to give you 12 years at this point.
Well, so it was all the more powerful when she turns to me and she's like, we got to do something. And in like kind of a nice way, like, look, Beto, you're a great guy, and I know you've been trying really hard, and you make great speeches, and you're voting the right way, and you're working on legislation with Republicans, but obviously this is not getting it done. And what she and I both kind of then talked about that night was, how are we going to talk about this with Ulysses?
Your oldest son.
Yeah, our oldest son, who at the time was 10 years old. How are we going to talk about this with Molly, 9 years old, or son Henry, who's seven? And not just what happened tonight and this election and with our country, but what we did. You know, did you continue to give great speeches and fight the good fight in the House, or did you really step up and do everything that you possibly could? And we thought, this is as big as you can possibly go, and have an opportunity to do the right thing for your country when your country needs you the most.
And then do you wake up the next morning and think, like, okay, like, seriously, run for Senate?
Right. I did. I had that you know.
Seems like a hangover from election.
Totally.
Night,
yeah. Right? I had that next morning check with Amy, and like turned to her and I was like, dude, do you remember this conversation? Which is a lot like the night I asked her to marry me the next morning. Like, turned to each other, like, is this what we're really going to do? And no. And she was like, yeah, I think this is what we're going to do. And almost immediately, you know, began to talk to and listen to friends and family in El Paso, and then in other parts of the state, and learned a hell of a lot. And also just became convinced that there are a lot of people like us who know that we can do far better and are willing to do the work necessary to achieve it.
You were elected to the House in 2012 for the first time. You won a primary against a sitting congressman. That was the same year that Ted Cruz was elected to the Senate for the first time in his own crowded primary.
Right.
By the time it got to the general election, though, you both won. Were there Cruz or Rourke voters there, you think, who voted for both of you?
You know, that's a great question. And I haven't even entertained it. And I need to think that through. You know, certainly there had to be some. You know, there may be some similarities in that we were both taking on status quo office holders who'd been there for a long time. Mm-hmm. And perhaps, I don't know enough about Cruz's race, but in ours, I mean, no one gave us a shot.
Obama endorsed your opponent, the sitting congressman. Did he ever apologize for that to you?
No. I don't even know if he remembers, but I remember the screaming El Paso Times headline, you know, Obama urges, or President urges El Paso to stick with Reyes. But before that, Bill Clinton comes to town, who is, you know, the most popular human being alive at that point in El Paso, packs the El Paso County Coliseum, standing room only, lines around the block for people who couldn't come in to endorse Reyes and urge folks to stick with Silver. I mean, I think the lesson for us there was that popularity is not transferable. And whether it's Obama, whether it's Clinton, it's anybody else. And we take that lesson to heart in anything that we're trying to do.
Have you talked to Bill Clinton since then?
No. I've never talked to Bill Clinton, nor have I spoken to Hillary Clinton ever. But yeah, you gotta win these things on your own. And our strategy, we made a virtue of a necessity. We didn't have money. We were outspent 5-1, and we just went door to door every single day. It was my full-time job. And except for part of Super Bowl Sunday, you know, Thanksgiving, Christmas,
not a good time to
and
knock
New Year's,
on people's door, yeah, I would imagine.
I'm going to leave you alone. Otherwise, you're going to hear from me. And I knew this was going to work when, well into the campaign, a guy stops me at a restaurant. And he's like, I don't know anything about you, but I'm going to vote for you because last week you knocked on my grandmother's door and you talked to her. And then this weekend, I and 20 of my cousins came to her house for dinner, and she made each of us promise to vote for you. And so, you know,
gotta get the grandma.
Yeah. So, you know, don't mess this up, all right? Because we're all behind you. And so it is painstaking, and it's a grind, and it's house by house, and it's like swimming across a lake. You think you're in the middle for forever, and the edge never comes closer fast enough. But it's the way to do this if you're gonna do it the right way. And it may have been the only way we could have won that race.
Tell me about Ted Cruz. You guys have been in the congressional delegation together for 5 years now, 5+. You're in the House, he's in the Senate, but you're both representing Texas. Have you dealt with him personally?
A little bit. When we were first elected, I went over to the Senate to meet with him just to share with him the priorities of our community in El Paso, the community that I represent in Congress, and had a very pleasant conversation that went beyond the issues to include, you know, our families, the elections that we had both recently won.
Do you like him personally?
Sure. Yeah. I mean,
it doesn't sound like
I don't have a problem. Yes. You know, I don't know him well enough, really, basically, to give you a better answer than that. But the other time that I approached him was in the midst of the 2013 shutdown. And I said, hey, my constituents in El Paso, who are also your constituents, are really suffering. Border Patrol agents, customs
officers. And
this is
2013 when he is basically the leader of this move for the shutdown.
Yeah.
And convinced the House, enough people in the House, that there was support for it. And it went on for 2 weeks, basically. Right?
Yeah. And families of service members and veterans, our office is just getting inundated with calls, and folks are coming into the El Paso office, and for good reason. You know, is the government going to reopen, and are we going to be able to do our jobs? And he just was not having any of it. It just moved him not in the
slightest.
You
went to go see him in his office?
No, we had a delegation-wide meeting. And it may have been in Senator Cornyn's office, in fact, with the whole Texas delegation. And so that was the case that I made to Senator Cruz. And I don't think he really cared in the slightest.
Is that the only conversations you've had with him in 5+ years, the only substantive conversation?
The only substantive. I will run into him from time to time.
I mean, he's your senator.
Right.
Right?
Why
do you think that is? Because you don't want to talk to him, or he doesn't want to
talk to you? No. We are always looking for partners in the work that we're doing. And in fact, I've been able to successfully partner with John Cornyn several
times. Your
other
senator.
My other senator, our senior senator, also a Republican. I've introduced legislation with John Cornyn and would seek to do the same with Ted Cruz. He just really, and this is not a judgment, this is just a fact, he just really was not interested in the job. He was running for president. And that became very clear within the first year of his time in the Senate. And he was literally physically not in Texas. He was in Iowa, and he was in New Hampshire, and he was in these other places. And so our partner, when we wanted to get something done in the Senate, was John Cornyn. That was a person whose calls, who when we called, the call was returned, who would hear us out on an idea, who would come to us sometimes and say, hey, here's something we can work on together, who would visit El Paso and walk the ports of entry with me and help make clear that the border is not fundamentally a threat. There's a great opportunity here. So
if the whole thing, everything happened in your with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and that night sitting there with your wife, and instead of Ted Cruz being up for re-election in 2018, John Cornyn had been up for re-election in 2018, would you have run against him?
I think so, and less because of John Cornyn or Ted Cruz, and more for what I think we need in Texas and what we should be able to do in this country, and things that we're missing today, the ability to move forward on big ideas and the priorities of people in our lives, the ability to see a doctor, which so many of us take for granted, but is missing from the lives of millions of my fellow Texans. We're the least insured state in the country. This idea that we would build a wall 2,000 miles, 30 feet high, cost of $25 to $30 billion with Mexico, instead of leading the country on immigration, which we understand and live better and more than anyone else anywhere in the country. This is a moment to stand up and be counted. And that's what moved us.
Do you think Cruz is different since the presidential run? Or is he the same guy?
I think he's the same guy. I mean, you know, not only was he the guy in 2013 who led the shutdown of the United States government over the Affordable Care Act, where now people could not be denied coverage for pre-existing conditions, would not have lifetime caps on their coverage, could afford to see a doctor. He's the same guy in 2018 who, when the Senate is just voting to begin the conversation, the debate on immigration, and to ensure that there is a path for Dreamers to stay in this country and perhaps to fully contribute as citizens, he's the lone senator to vote against moving forward.
Are you surprised that he has been allied with President Trump to the extent that he has, or that hasn't fought him more? They obviously had a very bitter end to the primary,
yeah,
with the whole Ted Cruz's father helped assassinate JFK, and then Cruz going to the podium at the Republican convention and specifically not endorsing Trump. But they have not really clashed on anything so far.
You know, I think that Ted Cruz has never been shy about his ambitions, and that his aspiration is not with Texas, but it is in being the president of the United States. And whatever furthers his ability to meet that goal will determine what he supports, what he opposes. And so
you think he's not fighting with Donald Trump because he still thinks he's going to run for president and that would be harmful?
I don't know how else to explain the turnabout from asking the delegates at the Republican National Convention to vote their conscience to the picture of him at a phone bank dialing for Donald Trump, from saying that I'm not in the habit of endorsing people who malign my wife and my father, to being his most full-throated supporter in the Senate right now. I don't know what else explains it. And obviously he should be asked and be given the chance to
explain. We hope that we'll have him on.
Yeah.
We've asked.
Yeah. So I think that's very much what's going on. But here's the thing, you know, it's not just Donald Trump who is seeking to undermine our institutions, whether it's the press, whether it's the Federal Bureau of Investigation, whether it's the judiciary, whether it's the ballot box. It is those who enable him or who stay silent in the face of it. And I would say one of his single greatest enablers is Ted Cruz. I'll give you one example. Donald Trump nominates a guy named Jeff Mateer to the federal bench in Texas. We later learn that Jeff Mateer has called transgender children part of Satan's plan. Cornyn, our senior senator, says, hold on a second. When I said move forward with this dude, I did not know he said that. Ted Cruz
says—
John
Cornyn is no lefty.
Yeah. Yeah. He's not, you're right. He's really conservative. And Ted Cruz says, no, that's our guy, Jeff Mateer. That's Texas. That's who we want. You know, Trump may say—
And where does that end up?
Here's where it ends up. The person who defeats that nomination is not Ted Cruz or even John Cornyn from Texas. It's Chuck Grassley, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, also a very conservative Republican, but someone with some principles, who says this person has no room passing judgment on anyone anywhere in this country. So I think this is a moment where this country is desperate for principled leadership, regardless of party or ideology or career. And this is the moment that it counts the most, and we're missing it right now in Texas.
Part of his thing seems to be portraying you essentially as like not a real Texan. Does it matter that he's from Canada?
Does it matter? No, it doesn't. I mean, the great thing about Texas is we're the most diverse state in the country. The coolest thing about El Paso is a quarter of those that I represent were born in another country. They chose us. The Cruz family chose Texas, and I love that. And it's the story of so many families who are in Texas today, making it such a successful state. But I think we got to learn from that example. I mean, we are the defining immigrant state. We should be leading the country on rewriting our immigration laws in our own image. Show the success of the Cruz family, the O'Rourke family, the Sanchez family, the Lee family. That's the success of Texas. That's the success of this country. Let's have more of it.
Another part of what he seems to be doing is to be contrasting being a liberal, which he says you are. Are you a liberal?
I don't know where I am on the spectrum. I'll give you some things that and you can use them as kind of a Rorschach test of political ideology. You know, anything of any significance that I've done in the House, I've done with a Republican colleague. And I work on the last two truly bipartisan committees, House Armed Services, House Veterans Affairs. I'm running a campaign in some of the most Republican counties in America. King County voted for Donald Trump 96% in Texas. I'm there in King County listening to people. I'm one of 28 Democrats that voted to give President Obama the authority to negotiate trade deals in the interest of the United States, in the interest of the U.S. worker, in the environment, human rights.
Which was something that was very much not popular with Democrats and was popular with House Republicans, although everything has been scrambled on that by President Trump. But the Cruz thing is that you are, he calls you a liberal and he contrasts that to being strong. It seems like that's the line that he's going with.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
I don't know. I don't know what that stuff means. Two cool LBJ moments. One is being in LaSalle County and going to the county seat in Cotulla, Texas, where LBJ taught school, public school teacher, before he was in politics, and seeing the big, beautiful mural of him and his class in the 1920s or 1930s.
I always wondered what he would be like as a teacher. It seems like not something that he was really suited to.
And it made
Did he make the students stand in the bathroom to like get their lessons?
Lean over them. But it had a profound impact on him. It informed how he saw civil rights and access to education and ensuring everybody could contribute to their potential. And I'm in 2 weeks ago, Archer City, and we're leaving the Spur Hotel, walking across the street to Mern's Cafe. And this guy stops me with a black and white photo of his dad having a cup of coffee in the American Legion Hall down the road from where we were with LBJ. And 70 years ago, almost to the day. And he said, that's the last time that a Senate candidate campaigned from either party in Archer City. So
that's 48, which was when LBJ was first elected to the Senate.
Yeah.
Perhaps with some help from stuffing a ballot box.
Yeah. That was a really strange election. But one of the things that characterized it was, and it's the way Democrats used to run, and it's the way Democrats used to win.
Is, stuffing ballot boxes?
No, is you show up.
There was a lot of that, though.
You show up in Archer City. You show up in Throckmorton. You show up in Baird and Coleman. You go to Lufkin and Nacogdoches. You're everywhere that people are that you want to represent and listen to and learn from. And so I think that's a time when Texas was leading, when we were kind of coming up with big ideas. That's the president who was so fundamental to civil rights legislation that would pass in a little more than 15 years from that date. We're not characterized by that kind of leadership today. It's the small stuff right now.
Last year, there was a House race in Georgia, a special election. There was a guy named John Ossoff, and he raised $26 million. People around the country who were pouring money into his campaign. You've done all right in fundraising. You beat Ted Cruz the beginning first 6 weeks of the year.
Right.
But it hasn't been that level yet. What does that tell you? Why not?
Why aren't we raising even more money?
No, well, I mean, you haven't become this national cause the way that Ossoff was, who was unknown. You've been in Congress, but most people don't know you. So on that, you're equal. He was running against a woman who also was unknown, whereas I would say it's fair to argue that Ted Cruz is better known and certainly among many activated liberals, much hated.
Right.
So why has the national attention not plugged into you yet?
I don't know. And there's not a whole bunch that I can do about it or control. So
do you want it?
I try not to think about it.
Because part of what happened with Ossoff,
to be honest with you, so one of the reasons that I'm so grateful to be working with this guy, Chris, on our campaign is we were in seven counties last Thursday, and each newspaper in each one of those counties came out. You know, so Chris calls ahead of time, or he has me call. He says, "Hey, I think you need to call the editor of the paper in Jacksonville or Jefferson or Paris or Cooper or Pittsburgh or any of these towns that we're going to, and make sure that they know that you care about what's going on in this town and that you want to answer their questions," which I do.
I want to make sure they know. As a former community newspaper reporter, that when the politicians call them, when you're running for Senate, you can get some attention from that.
Yeah. And you know what? I want you to know, even if you couldn't come out to the event in Pittsburgh, we set it up with short notice, 2 days notice, and had a great turnout. More than 100 people came, but there are a lot more folks in Pittsburgh. And so how do we reach them? Let's make sure that the newspaper has a chance to be part of this town hall and listen to the questions that are brought that I respond to, and that we spend some time talking with that reporter. That article in the Pittsburgh paper or my interview with the Longview editorial board last week is more meaningful than anything the New York Times or
but
the LA
Times.
But
you don't want like Alyssa Milano tweeting about you?
No. No. And she's, I'm sure, a great person too. This is going to be decided by Texas and by Texans.
It seems like part of what happened in that House race is that there was a backlash to it. So is that part of the worry here? That too much sort of national liberal attention, national Democratic attention is not what the Texas voters want.
Yeah, it may hurt. My takeaway is I don't know that it ever helps. And I just, again, use the example of, you know, Bill Clinton coming to town when we're running against the incumbent who's outspending us 5-1. And we think, oh, gosh, this is over.
Right.
And it wasn't over, because while El Pasoans love Bill Clinton, they're not going to take orders from Bill Clinton. They want to come out and get their, you know, picture taken with him or get an autograph or see him or hear what he has to say. But they've decided that they're going to make their own decision. And I think that's broadly the way that we in Texas think about things.
A couple months ago, Will Hurd was on the podcast. He's a Republican congressman from Texas. He's a friend of yours. You guys have done a cross-country trip together that you were on Facebook Live the whole time
too,
for.
Too much,
it,
right?
It was, yeah. It's how many hours? So like 14
there was,
hours
there
or something?
There was 29 hours of live stream and 36 hours together. 29 of it live streamed.
Yeah, the most thrilling documentary that's ever been
right.
made.
Who in their right mind was watching any of that, right? So, yeah.
Yes, but it was because you were dealing with the weather and getting, you were driving from Texas to Washington, right?
San Antonio, D.C.
I said to him, well, what do you think about your friend Beto running for Senate? And he said, well, you know, I like him. He's my friend, but like, he knows it's not going to work. And I called you on the phone. I don't know if you remember right after that. And I said, well, this is what he said. What do you think of it?
I remember I was in a Walmart parking lot in Houston buying diapers and filtered water because we were taking it to a shelter in the Houston area. I remember that phone call.
That's a politician citing your work on hurricane relief.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's literally where I was. I remember it.
And you said to me, yeah, I'm not surprised he said that. He's a Republican. It makes sense for him to support Ted Cruz. But what struck me about it was your acceptance of how unlikely this seems and knowing what you're doing, right? Like the chances that this ends with you being Senator Beto O'Rourke are, at least for the moment, they don't seem that high. So how do you make it through each day, right? Because do you think you're going to win?
I do. And it's got to be inside you or you won't win. And it's got to be inside you in such a way that the looks that you get from not just people like Will Hurd, who's a Republican, but from good friends of mine who are Democrats that I serve with in the House, who give me that look of like, hey, good luck. And I can see from their look, they're like, you're going to fucking lose this thing. There's no way you're going to pull this off. But hey, give it the college try and we're with you. You know, I'll tell you that perhaps I'm a nerd to it in some way, because that was the look I got when I ran for city council in 2005 against the mayor pro tem. And folks were like, no way. Or when I ran against Sylvester Reyes in 2012. And I'm not saying that this race will be like those races, but those looks were a lot like the looks that I'm getting now.
But so you're simultaneously in your head, you've got the thought you are going to win, and you know it's crazy to think that you're going to win.
Yeah, I can understand. Let me put this diplomatically. I can understand how people think that this is crazy, that I think that I'm going to win. But so much of this is crazy, right? Like, what is this guy doing from El Paso? El Paso has produced precisely zero statewide victories in the history of the state of Texas. Last time a Democrat won was in 1988 for U.S. Senate, Lloyd Benson. So why in the world, against Ted Cruz of all people, that guy almost won the Republican presidential nomination. But for Donald Trump and a really extraordinary year, he may very well have won and could be our president right now. So why in the world would you go up against this guy? But I think the confidence is born not out of, you know, any kind of mental illness, but out of what I am seeing and hearing. And so, you know, Amy saying, get out of here and go get after it in November. And me just listening to people, traveling, making phone calls, meeting with the mayor of Lubbock, who's a Republican, but I don't care. Tell me what's going on in Lubbock and what you care about and what's exciting to you. Meeting with the mayor of Wichita Falls.
Mayor of Lubbock going to support you?
I don't know. Didn't ask. And many of these conversations were just, I just want to understand what's happening and know if there's something that I can do to make things better. And came away from those conversations convinced that not only could I make things better if I were able to serve, and not only did I have partners in all of these communities, but that people felt much the way that Amy and I felt, and they were willing to do what they had not done in years past, including voting or volunteering, or I can't say how often I hear someone say, this is the first time I've ever canvassed or knocked on doors. You saw it in the turnout in the Texas primary, you know, a million Democrats came out and voted, which is the high watermark for a midterm Senate campaign, I think going back more than 30 years. There's definitely energy.
It wasn't absolutely. The numbers in the primary weren't quite what Texas Democrats were hoping for. The early voting numbers certainly were much higher. But right. Have you talked to Doug Jones about your run? Strikes me there's a similar thing going on there, right? He ran in a race briefly. That he was not supposed to win.
Yeah, briefly. And he just said, hey, let me know if I can be helpful. And, you know, you can do this. That was about the extent of the conversation.
I know that
he was sitting in front of me at the State of the Union. So that was, we just had this brief exchange.
So sitting on the floor for the State of the Union, right. You talk about unlikely Senate runs.
Yeah, just introducing myself. And I think.
But it must feel good. Like his entire candidacy took place within the time you announced that you were running. I think before he announced he was running, and he won because it was a special election. So there was a race before, and now you're still running. I mean, it must feel like, okay, well, if Doug Jones can get elected in Alabama, right? Like you're maybe like 1% less crazy or something.
That's right. And a conclusion also shared by people in Texas who may have before not allowed themselves to believe, but you know, Trump wins Alabama by 28 points, wins Texas by 9. Roy Moore was more popular on the eve of that election in Alabama than Ted Cruz is in Texas.
Sure, but he also had a series of revelations that I don't think anybody expects to happen. Not anything like it for Ted Cruz. Cruz has been picked over. If there was something like that, I think we would know.
Right.
So there's no reason to believe that there is something, some surprise like that coming. And I think that's part of the issue with Doug Jones is that probably Roy Moore would have won if not for what came out.
Yeah. Right? I don't know. All I know is if you just look in apples to apples in what their relative popularity was on the eve of that election, what Ted Cruz's is today, Ted Cruz is less popular among his fellow Texans than Roy Moore was among the folks in Alabama. And that doesn't say that this is a slam dunk. This doesn't say that they're the same thing. All it says to a lot of people is that this is possible.
And so when the Republicans,
for a lot of people, it was impossible.
And when the Republicans say like, okay, like how many times are you going to tell us Texas is going to turn blue? Battleground Texas, blah, blah, blah. Ron Kirk wasn't a senator when he ran. Wendy Davis didn't win the governor's election 4 years ago. You know, there was a lot of trouble convincing top flight people to run for governor this year. It's not borne out in what's happening in the elections. I know you say that you don't want to, it's a non-voting state, right? That's your line. Yeah. You need to get people to vote. But how are you going to get them to vote if there are enough Democrats out there, but they just haven't been voting? Why are they suddenly going to show up?
I mean, you got to ask them, but they have been turning out in record numbers so far in this election. When, you know, 1,000 people come out to see us on a Saturday morning in Roanoke, Texas, in Tarrant County, which is the largest reliably red urban county in the United States, that tells you something's happening. And I won't even pretend for a minute to say that that's me or our campaign. There's something happening in Texas that we get to be a part of. And we're doing everything we can to be honest to that. You know, being a 254 county campaign, listening in town halls, not taking a dime of PAC money or special interest contributions, corporate support, just doing this in the most direct, honest way that I know how. Not only is it the right way to win, I think that's the only way to win.
You're not going to answer this question. I'm asking anyway. One of your friends in Congress, one of the people who is probably somewhere past the like, all right, go for it, and like actually sort of believing in this, said to me, if Beto wins, it's so crazy that like he will be on the short list for vice president. People will be talking about him running for president. He'll be the guy who took down Ted Cruz. What do you make of that?
Not much. I think just to get to the spirit of that, I want to make sure everyone knows that I'm focused on Texas and that I'm committed to, as preposterous as the idea might be of me ever being considered, you know, vice presidential or presidential material, I want to serve in the United States Senate for Texas for a full 6 years. No ifs, ands, or buts. I think so many of my fellow Texans, including Republicans, are so disappointed that Ted Cruz spent so much of his first term pursuing the presidency at the expense of Texas, our opportunities, our needs, the things that were happening in our state that he was not there to be a part of.
He'd have been a fine senator if he hadn't been running for president.
Have been a much better senator if he hadn't been running for president. Even just the constituent caseload of showing up in a place like Wichita Falls or Waco, Texas, and listening to the people that you serve and represent. The biggest consistent laugh line that I can get on the road is if someone asks me a question at a town hall and I respond by saying, I'm going to answer your question, but first tell me how Ted Cruz answered that question when you asked him at the town hall that he hosted here in Lufkin or Pecos or Amarillo or El Paso or anywhere, because he just has never done that.
So you're just like trolling him in absentia.
Yeah. No, I think we're
has he talked to you about, have you talked since you announced that you were running for Senate?
I don't know. You know, I briefly, we've been at some meetings together with the entire Texas delegation, and I always make an effort to go by and say hello and shake his hand. And
what's that interaction like?
Nice. And
it doesn't
brief.
Say like, no, you're going to lose.
The only thing I can remember him saying is maybe the first time we saw each other after I announced, is he said something like, it's going to be an interesting campaign or something. Nice thing. And he had just for the first time in the 5 years that he'd been in the Senate, just visited El Paso, which is the sixth largest city. I said, hey, heard you were in El Paso. We, as an El Pasoan, as a constituent of yours, grateful that you showed up. Hope it was a good visit.
He's a fantastic debater, was a national champion in
Absolutely.
College,
yeah.
Argued in front of the Supreme Court. What would a debate between the two of you look like?
I don't know, but I'm eager to be part of that. And I think he is too, because he is so good at that. And I think he actually has a very clear, defined idea of where this country should go. And
it seems to.
And I do as well. And I think that debate of ideas and also of service and record is precisely what our fellow Texans should have as they make their decision at the ballot box. On any given issue, Ted's going to have a point of view. I'm going to have a point of view. And neither of us shy away from it or use mushy language to evade taking a position. And I think it's rare that you get that.
It is a clash of worldviews here.
Yeah.
And I think there are obviously a lot of people who agree with Senator Cruz's worldview, not
Absolutely.
Only in Texas, but beyond. A lot of people voted for him. And you have a very different approach.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a very different background. And you're not getting that in that level of contrast in most of the Senate races going on. It's part of the reason why I think it's interesting to look at this race. Every time that we've spoken on the phone, and I know this is not just with me, you end up by saying adios. Why is that? I mean, I understand that's how you say goodbye. I'm not.
Yeah, right. What does that word mean? I don't know. It's just.
Was that
I
like
am.
In politics you started, or like when you were in your punk rock band, were you saying adios to people at the end of conversations?
I honestly don't know because it's just the thing that I do naturally. So I'm not aware even of doing it unless someone points it out and says something about it. I also think, you know, in El Paso, it's not uncommon for people to include Spanish when they're speaking English, or to include English phrases when they're speaking Spanish. So I think that is something that's characteristic of the community in which I was raised. And
you're not the only person who ends conversations by saying adios, even
right.
conversations in English, which if you were speaking Spanish to me, it would be a problem since I don't speak Spanish.
Right.
My mother made me take French and Latin.
That's coming useful.
The Latin is really useful, and the French is useful when you're in France or in Quebec or
right.
a couple of other places, but
right.
But certainly not as useful
not
in
so
El Paso.
Much in the US. Yeah.
But adios, I've got down.
Yeah, good. You're on a roll.
All right. Congressman Beto O'Rourke, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me on.
It's true. I did spend my time in school taking French and Latin. 6 years of Latin, and then more French when I got to college. But I'll keep to podcasting in English. We'll see what happens with O'Rourke over the course of the year. So far, most people still think he's a long shot. But I don't know anyone who would have thought this far out that Donald Trump or Doug Jones would have been in any shape to win their elections. Thanks as always to Zach Stanton for producing. Remember to subscribe and tell a friend or family member so you won't miss any episode coming up. Pete Buttigieg, Matt Gaetz, Michael Tubbs, Ricardo Rossello, and many more. Follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dover and shoot me your thoughts at isaac@politico.com. And catch you next time on Off Message.